You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to Governor Evers' pick to run the state's Department of Corrections about what the governor's budget has to say about criminal justice reform. First, Time magazine recently came out with its annual list of the 100 most influential people. They include well-known personalities like President Donald Trump, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Taylor Swift, Dwayne Johnson, Gayle King, and some lesser-known names, including African businessman Fred Swanaker, venture capitalist Aileen Lee, and Swedish teen climate change activist Greta Thunberg. Who do you think is the most influential person in the world, and why? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you checked out Time's list, who do you agree with? Who do you think they left off? And what does influential mean anyway? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mike Wagner is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a hard word to define. Time goes up. It's a pretty broad brush of the idea of influential. What kind of things do you think of when you think of influence in this day and age?
Well, I think we could think about influence in terms of how we are talking about what someone does, how the way we live our lives changes because of what someone or some group does, how we have come to understand some typical concept differently because of what someone or some group does. And so I think those are ways that we see a lot of influence. The thing, change in terms of what happens or how we think about things, I would say, is probably where Time is trying to come from when they put together this list.
And as you go through the names, and it's a mixed bag, what do you think? What do you think of how Time handled that and who they put on the list?
Well, it's super American. There's a lot of Americans on the list, given our percentage of population in the world, probably overrepresented. But of course, then Time is a magazine here in the United States. Not
sure.
At all surprising that they put a lot of Americans on the list. They have a mix of entertainers and business and politics. They have old guard and new guard. They have a relatively broad list, but it's also it's very much a mainstream news media list where I was just actually talking about this in the hall with a former student of mine. You know, Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh are on the same list, and you don't see that a lot. And it's kind of an example of how the mainstream news media like to give you a broad, both sides kind of take on how the world looks.
I look at it in some ways as like, what are the 10 best albums of all time, or you know, best movies? It's a conversation starter, and I think there's some interesting conversations to be provoked by this list.
Oh, for sure, for sure. Although the 10 best albums list has a set of right answers, I think, but I think you're exactly right. This is it's a way to start talking about why we might care about the people who are on the list, but it's also a way for people to say, hey, what about this? This was left off. And, you know, it's always like when the March Madness 64 teams are announced, there's always a set of conversations about who got left off and who should have been in that tournament. And so I think it's the same with this list. Who didn't get on the list of influential people sometimes is just as interesting of a conversation as who's on it and why they're on it.
We had a couple comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tim writes, I'm impressed with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and what she's been doing. Wish I could have voted for her. There's no voting, I think, involved in this process, and hope she inspires others. Now, she was on the list. She's gotten a lot of, in some ways, outsized attention for a rookie person in Congress. I mean, she won a dramatic victory over a longtime Democratic insider, a lot of attention from the left and from the right. I mean, it is an interesting kind of influence to talk about.
Yeah, you know, she's a fascinating case because a lot of things that she's done are incredibly unique. As you say, she beats a long-term incumbent in her own party in the primary. She has kind of mastered social media communication in the kind of direct opposite way that President Trump has mastered it. They're both kind of social media savants, Trump by being negative and attacking, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez by being positive and then by kind of clapping back to people who come after her. And so she's really good at both of those things. She's very good at showing what her life is like and what the lives of her staff and constituents are like on social media. And she also, because of that attention, both from the mainstream media and Republicans, who are now kind of making her a focus in their fundraising letters, she's getting a lot of attention from both sides, which only amplifies her influence.
Now, there are some political figures who people might like them, they might not want, but clearly they are important people who have an influence on the world. President Trump,
sure.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi,
Mitch McConnell
both on
in the Senate, yep.
Right, and Mitch McConnell wrote the one about Brett Kavanaugh
well.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So whether you like them or not, influence doesn't necessarily mean positive or negative. It can go either way.
And Time has a history of that way of thinking about the world with Person of the Year.
Right.
Stalin won Person of the Year, but not for good reasons, right?
Right.
And so, Time, I think, is trying to start a conversation about who matters, not who's doing good.
Now, one thing that was maybe a little less American-centric, even though one of these two people was American, they did some sports figures, LeBron
yep,
James,
right.
An obvious one, I think, two soccer players out of the 100, Mo Salah, the Egyptian soccer star, and then Alex Morgan, the American woman soccer player. They both got profiled in that. It's interesting that this American magazine featured two soccer players and their most influential people.
It is. I think, you know, soccer is an increasingly popular game in the U.S. It's the most popular sport in the world, I think. The American women's soccer team is a dominant force in global play, and so it's not surprising to see them get some attention on the merits. It's surprising, I would say, given the history of the attention we give to soccer in the country. It's a little surprising to see, but it's becoming more popular. More and more parents, I think, are pushing their kids to soccer other than more contact concussion-y sports. So I think that's probably part of soccer's growing influence as well.
As a soccer dad, there's still those concussion
worries. They still are, right.
Definitely. We're talking to Mike Wagner. Time Magazine came out just a little while back with their list of the 100 most influential people in the world. A little American-focused, as Mike was saying, but it's always a conversation starter. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have someone you'd think should be on the list of influential people. That's 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller. Ed is with us in Milwaukee. Ed, hi.
I think that we're so illiterate in terms of, culturally illiterate in terms of the arts. I would bring up the new conductor of the New York Philharmonic, but I think that 99% of all Americans don't even know who he is. So I'm going to talk about Thomas Pynchon, who sort of crossed over into the world of pop culture. He wrote the second, the best American novel in the second half of the 20th century, Gravity's Rainbow, and he's very slightly photographed. And he made an appearance, at least two, on The Simpsons. So that would nominate Thomas Pynchon.
Ed, thanks for the call. So a novelist like Thomas Pynchon. Now, the Time Magazine list tends to be people who have something going on this year or something new. And I don't think there's a new release from Thomas Pynchon. But it's an interesting argument to talk about major novelists.
Yeah, my understanding is that their list is for this year. And there's plenty of novelists who've written books that came out in the last 12 months that are important conversation pieces and, you know, book club kind of things all over the country. But Pynchon's a big deal. You know, Inherent Vice, I think, also a popular book that became a movie,
yeah,
is more recent, but still not 2019. But, you know, I was just reading the other day that reading and reading books by holding them in your hands is starting to make a bit of a comeback. Mm-hmm. In terms of how people are living their lives and liking to do that. And so having novelists or poets on that list, it will certainly make sense.
And they have, thanks for that call, Ed, they have some novelists, musicians, of course,
right.
I think a fashion designer, a paint artist.
Yep.
Again, there is a fair amount of culture there for Ed.
It's a wide range. There's the painters, novelists, venture capitalists, political activists and organizers, politicians, some leaders of other countries, some people trying to engage in civic engagement and activism globally as well.
Yeah. So what kind of, if you were talking to your students about this, what kind of conversations would you hope a list like this might provoke, Mike?
I would love to have a conversation where if I was teaching a class and we were dealing with this for a day, I would like to have the students say, okay, let's pretend that we're the committee. What criteria are we going to use to decide who's influential? Are we going to look at how many times their name is Googled? Are we going to look at how many Twitter followers they have or how many likes they get on Instagram? Are we going to look at more qualitative examples of our sense of their importance in the zeitgeist? Are we going to think about what are our own blind spots in this room and what aren't we going to be looking for that we should be looking for? It'd be fun to go through that process to decide how you decide.
That's a lot of fun. And Mike, let me just put a bug in your ear. What if we were to try to do most influential of the 20th century, the previous century to ours? How would you start doing something like that?
That would be really fun as well. I guess I would start by culling lists like this one, mm-hmm. You know, looking at Person of the Year kind of things, or looking at year-end retrospectives where you have the top 10 books, top 10 albums, top 10, that sort of thing. I think you'd want to look at major political figures and civic figures. I think you'd also want to look at contemporary historical research that often uncovers things that were happening that we weren't aware of when it was happening before. And so I think a mixed strategy like that might be really useful.
Mike, thanks for joining us. We can both start our campaigns to be on the list in 2020.
We were robbed this year.
Mike Wagner is a professor in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people of this current year. Coming up, some advocates are criticizing Governor Evers' budget for not doing enough on criminal justice reform. We'll talk to the secretary designee at the State Department of Corrections. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, one of President Trump's backers is withdrawing from consideration for a seat on the Federal Reserve Board. We'll find out why he's stepping back and check in on the week's other big political news. First, criminal justice advocates had big hopes for Governor Tony Evers' administration, with then-candidate Evers supporting reducing the state's prison population by half and talking about ending solitary confinement. Now that his first budget is out with his initial set of policy priorities, some advocates are saying he's moved criminal justice reform to the back burner. Kevin Carr joins us for a look at the governor's budget priorities. He's secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Secretary designee Carr, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me today, and thank you to your listeners for joining us.
What would you say to people who say, hey, we were excited about what Tony Evers had to say as a candidate about criminal justice reform? We're not seeing those priorities reflected in the budget.
What I would say to those who would say that is just wait and see. The governor's only been in office for 3.5 months, and there's much work to be done, and there's there's some time left to do it.
What kind of things do you see in the budget that do fit that bill, of things that'll change our criminal justice system here in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, the one thing that I'm extremely proud that the governor included in his budget that is going to definitely impact criminal justice reform is the amount of money that he's allocated for reentry programs in the state of Wisconsin in our budget at DOC. For instance, our Opening Avenues to Reentry Success program, which focuses on the needs of mentally ill persons who are released from our facilities and entering our communities, they're going to receive additional mental health treatment, job training, medication, housing, and other supports. In order to maximize their potential to successfully reenter our communities. Now, we currently provide that program in 44 counties around the state, and Governor Evers has expanded that effort to all 72 counties in the state. He also supports our Windows to Work program and has funded 4 additional job centers to help those who are about to leave our facilities look for employment in the communities when they leave our facilities.
Can you talk about the importance of those two main things you just talked about, job training and mental health treatment, when it comes to making sure people don't end up back in prison after they get out?
Well, you know, I know the governor has talked about it many times that we have to provide more resources for mental health AODA treatment for those under our supervision and those in the community before they even enter the system. And that's why he supports the Treatment Alternatives and Diversion Program, the TAD money.
AOD, alcohol and other drugs.
Right.
Now, you're also in the budget looking to boost staffing for some court positions at the county level. Can you talk about what you're asking for there?
I think the
public defender funding is part of that.
That's not in my budget.
Oh, it's not in your budget.
No, I can't comment on that.
Gotcha. Okay. Marijuana decriminalization, again, that's dealing with people who aren't in the correction system yet. But do you see that as part of the puzzle?
Well, the governor believes that the disparate impact, first of all, the medical marijuana issue is something that is strongly supported by the citizens of this state. And the governor, through the listening sessions that he's had with everyday citizens all around the state, strongly support not only the medical marijuana issue, but the decriminalization of marijuana because of the disparate impact that it has on persons of color, especially in our most urbanized areas of the state.
Also, I want to talk about Wisconsin's parole system. Now, this, as I understand it, applies only to people who were already incarcerated before changes in Wisconsin's sentencing laws. That said, what are you looking at when it comes to parole here in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, the governor is in the midst of selecting a new parole commissioner, and I believe that with a new commissioner comes a new perspective on parole eligibility and a more expansive view of who should be eligible for that parole.
Do you think there's a need to actually parole more people currently incarcerated who've been in the system for a long time?
I think based on the current three-tiered system that we have right now that consists of old law prisoners, truth in sentencing prisoners, and new law prisoners makes it complicated to deal with all three of those separate type of populations when it comes to calculating release dates and what have you. But I do believe that a lot of the old law prisoners and truth in sentencing prisoners should have the opportunity for being considered for parole.
Talking to Kevin Carr, Governor Evers' appointee as the Secretary of the State's Department of Corrections, about the new state budget and priorities for that department. Secretary Carr, one of the biggest issues you'll be facing as Secretary of the Department of Corrections has to do with the state's juvenile correctional facilities, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. Long-running story there, concerns about abuses, concerns about staffing and staff safety. This plan in place to try to remove all residents there and place them at other facilities around the state. It's complicated. What are you looking at when it comes to Lincoln Hills?
Well, Governor Evers and I have discussed this matter several times, and both of us are in agreement that we will close Lincoln Hills as soon as humanly possible, as long as we have an acceptable place to move our youth. If we could close Lincoln Hills today, we would. But under Act 185, which was passed by the legislature last year, we're required to pursue building two new Type 1 facilities, one in Milwaukee and one in Hortonia. There's a third one that could be on deck if we, if the governor so chose to build it, but we don't want to overbuild. Also, as a part of that legislation, the counties have the opportunity to apply for a grant in order to build new county facilities to use a model that is called Closer to Home, which has been proven nationally to be more therapeutic and provide better outcomes for the youth that are provided a more trauma-informed care model of treatment.
Do you want to see more attention paid to diversion, keeping people from that first contact, maybe with law enforcement, setting them on a path so they don't even end up in that juvenile justice system?
Absolutely. The literature and the science shows that community-based alternatives to incarceration certainly are more effective than the cost and ineffectiveness of using residential long-term facilities.
Now, getting back to the budget itself, one part that's gotten some attention is projections showing that our adult inmate population in Wisconsin will grow and continue to grow and budgeting accordingly. Why are we seeing this increase in the expected adult inmate population?
There are many factors for the increase in the population. A lot of it has to do with policing and sentencing at the local level. But I would certainly tell you that the governor is very anxious to get criminal justice reform discussions underway. We believe that it needs to be a bipartisan effort in order for it to be successful, because the impacts of criminal justice reform legislation will be so long-lasting and far-reaching that there needs to be some broad consensus on the direction that the state moves in. The governor has every intention of working with the legislature to make those things happen that will reduce our overall prison population in the state of Wisconsin. It's happened in states all around the country successfully, where they've been able to safely reduce prison population while increasing public safety, and that's what the governor's goal is, and mine as well.
Now, you said earlier, just wait and see for people who are looking for more in terms of criminal justice reform, that the budget's just part of the story. Does that mean we should be looking for separate proposals from the governor that he'll bring to the legislature?
Yes, and I would also say that you may end up seeing a bipartisan package of reforms that seriously impact criminal justice reform. That is the desire, is that we do it on a bipartisan basis so that everybody has some skin in the game and has bought into the reforms that we anticipate.
Now let's look 4 years ahead from now after one term for the governor. Looking back at that point, what would success look like for you in your time as Secretary of the Department of Corrections?
If in 4 years what I would like to see success is, I'd love to see the recidivism rate drop because we have improved the outcomes as it relates to our reentry efforts. I would love to see our population of persons in custody decrease by a significant amount because we've been able to work together on a bipartisan basis to enact smart criminal justice reform that doesn't compromise public safety at all. And I'd like to see our staffing level improve here at DOC, which will allow us to provide a higher level of care and service to those in our custody, as well as reward the hardworking men and women of DOC for their efforts, because without them, we don't get anything done. And they should be commended for working in some very difficult situations with a very difficult clientele.
Secretary Designee Carr, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Kevin Carr, Secretary Designee of Wisconsin's Department of Corrections. He was with us today for a look at Governor Evers' budget when it comes to corrections issues in the state. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to an advocate from the Milwaukee-based reform group Wisdom about the kinds of things he thinks the budget should include when it comes to criminal justice. That's tomorrow at 3:30. Coming up after the news, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson is preparing a bill that would make it more difficult for immigrants to qualify for asylum in the U.S. We'll get the details in our weekly roundup of national news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to a Republican state lawmaker who wants to see more out of Governor Evers' budget when it comes to conservation funding. First, we're checking in on some of the big stories in national politics. President Trump and his team are still talking a lot about the Mueller report after its release last week. Herman Cain is withdrawing from consideration for a seat at the Federal Reserve Board. And Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson is planning a bill that would tighten the standards for immigrants hoping to qualify for asylum status here in the U.S. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think an idea like Senator Johnson's to make it more difficult to claim asylum is a good plan? Should we limit the number of asylum claims or use more resources to process the claims we do have? And which party's message on immigration do you think will reach out to voters in the 2020 elections? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Seungmin Kim is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. Seungmin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Let's start with the reaction from the Trump administration post-Mueller report. When Attorney General Barr put out that initial summary, that four-page deal, President Trump claimed it was total exoneration. Now we've had the full and redacted report last week. What have we been hearing from President Trump and his team?
Well, the president and his inner circle are still claiming that it is total exoneration, which we know from the report itself is not true. The attorney, both the attorney general and the special counsel Robert Mueller himself, have made it clear that particularly on that obstruction of justice question, there are still a lot of the special counsel just could not reach a determination one way or the other on that issue. And actually, Mr. Mueller detailed at least 10 episodes of potential obstruction of justice that he had investigated as part of his lengthy conclusion. So the president, especially after initially that report or the Barr letter was released, had been in a really good mood. Because he did see this as sort of lifting this big cloud over his presidency. And similarly, Kellyanne Conway, who is the White House counselor, came out and talked to us at the White House the same day that the redacted report was released and said, this is the best day of his presidency. But if you look at what the president's been saying, and also if you look at the president's tweets and his continued anger towards the Mueller report, you do see that he is still clearly frustrated with the toll that this investigation took on him, or that's what his allies tell us, and that this still, and that there is a lot of damning information out there that was laid out in detail by the special counsel. Now, we're really in a phase right now where the president and his administration is really battling with Democrats in Congress who have just ramped up the subpoenas, ramped up the requests for information. And I thought the president's comments today were really striking when before he left to go to Atlanta for a summit on opioids, he told the White House reporters on the lawn, that on the White House lawn, that we are fighting all the subpoenas. We knew that kind of defiant attitude was coming, but it was really remarkable to hear it straight from the president's mouth.
Right. And some Democrats have responded saying the president is stonewalling, a Watergate allusion there, I think. And then there's questions among Democrats about how much investigating should we do? Should we be talking about impeachment at this stage? What are we hearing now from the House Democratic majority?
Well, when it comes to that question of impeachment, they are so divided on this issue right now. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, has been really trying to tamp down the impeachment talk for actually weeks now, saying it's too premature, let's wait till we see the report. Now that the report is out, she is still exercising a lot of caution. So Nancy Pelosi and her leadership team feel that they are on solid ground, seeking more information and continuing their investigations. So, for example, you're going to continue to hear calls from the appropriate chairman, Nancy Pelosi, other members of her leadership, saying the full unredacted report should be sent to Congress for their review, which is something that so far the administration has not been willing to provide them for various reasons. Also, the Jerry Nadler, who is the House Judiciary Committee chairman, is continuing more of the committee's investigation into these episodes of potential obstruction of justice that was laid out in the Mueller report. So they feel fine about investigation, but it's really impeachment that has stymied the caucus. I mean, they've already had a lot of internal discussions this week about how people feel on the impeachment question. You have various House members saying there's already enough evidence here for us to start impeachment proceedings. And I thought it was almost a split screen of sorts yesterday when the House Speaker is up in New York speaking at the Time Magazine summit saying, I am not there yet when it comes to the question of impeachment, while one of our own prominent House Chairman, Maxine Waters, who has long been a supporter of impeachment, is, rattling off a very lengthy Twitter thread listing out the reasons for why impeachment proceedings need to begin right away. So it is a very difficult task facing Nancy Pelosi right now.
Before we move on from Mueller report fallout, one more item. Back in 2017, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders told White House reporters that countless FBI agents supported the president's decision to fire FBI Director James Comey. She repeated that sentiment. We now know that she told investigators those comments weren't based on anything. Here she is talking about that recently on Fox News.
I acknowledge that I had a slip of the tongue when I used the word countless, but it's not untrue. And certainly you just echoed exactly the sentiment and the point that I was making is that a number of both current and former FBI agents agreed with the president.
As a White House reporter yourself, how do you match up these statements?
I think that, I mean, Sarah Sanders has clearly come under a lot of questioning for her credibility, particularly in the aftermath of the report. And she was questioned on some of the morning news shows the day after the redacted report was released. And it does, I mean, people who have been around the block much longer than I have in terms of covering administration say this has been unprecedented in terms of credibility. And, you know, credibility, you know, you live and die by your credibilities. So that's what other folks have said. Clearly, though, in her interviews after the report was released, she still was saying this was only a slip of the tongue. And I'm sorry if I'm not, you know, quote, like a robot, like Democratic robots. You know, that she has to just repeat certain phrases over and over. So that will be another something to continue to watch as well.
It's our weekly roundup of national politics. Soongmin Kim is with us from The Washington Post. Let's move on now. Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson, chair of the Homeland Security Committee, is planning a legislation that would tighten the rules around seeking asylum. What kind of changes is he looking for?
So he's been really targeting a couple of things that Republicans of both in Congress and the administration have wanted to target for some time. So first of all, you've heard the president repeatedly decry so-called catch and release. So basically what happens is that minors who come to the United States can only be held under a 1997 legal settlement for 20 days, and then they have to be released. Often they are released to a sponsor elsewhere in the United States. But 20 days is a short time, obviously not a long enough time to process a lot of these asylum claims. And also, so if you're, for example, if you're a child traveling alone, or if you are a parent who has traveled with a minor, unless you want to be separated, you tend to often get released alongside your child after the 20 days. But Republicans such as Senator Johnson have been looking into this issue and say, obviously, you have to discourage the illegal immigration. You have to, and that means deporting people and removing people who have to be removed. And it's difficult to do that when asylum claims aren't processed quickly, and a lot of people have been released before their claims are processed. So part of his legislation that he's been working on is to change the law so that migrants who arrive at the southern border who have pending asylum claims are detained longer. He says that'll expedite the process. And also that basically the standards for claiming asylum should be tougher. For example, in the asylum process, the big first major step that applicants have to cross is so-called credible fear standard. I mean, do they have this level of fear of going back to their home country? And nearly 90% of asylum seekers clear that first hurdle. Senator Johnson says that's an indication that perhaps the current asylum standards are a little too lax. And he says he would like to see that tightened to more like maybe perhaps a 50% level.
In my limited understanding of asylum law, Soongmin, I understand the U.S. kind of matches up with international law when it comes to standards for asylum. Would Senator Johnson's legislation kind of uncouple us from international definitions of a refugee of credible fear?
Well, you laid out another one of the obstacles in drafting this because asylum law is so tightly tied to international law. So, for example, when the administration said last year during the whole family separation issue that asylum seekers have to arrive at a specific port of entry on the southern border to be able to apply for asylum, experts in international law said no, like under, you know, essentially international law, asylum law, like you can apply for asylum anywhere on U.S. soil, essentially. So that shows one major hurdle into accomplishing the changes that Senator Johnson and other Republicans are seeking. But another challenge is obviously clearly, is there the political will to get this done? Trump is pushing Congress. He has obviously shown an inclination to act on his own if Congress doesn't help. But this is an issue that has stymied Congress for years, and I don't see that changing anytime soon, even with efforts from Senator Johnson and others to try to fix the system.
We're talking with We're talking with Seungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with the rise in immigrants being apprehended and detained at the border. What do you want to see from Congress? Do you support an idea like we've been hearing about from Senator Ron Johnson that would narrow who can qualify in those early stages of applying for asylum? Should we be devoting more resources to processing these cases for people who are already here? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Seungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. We're rounding up some of the top stories in national politics. Go to your calls now on immigration issues and Senator Ron Johnson's plan, his proposed legislation that would tighten asylum standards, make it harder for people to clear some of the early stages in the asylum process. Owen is on the line in Wauwega. Owen, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call this evening, Rob. Yeah, so this is a good step on the PR spectrum that Senator Johnson's working on. The thing that I don't understand that really puzzles me is a lot of Republicans hire immigrants, and a lot of the immigrants the Republicans hire might not have even crossed through an asylum-seeking process. So I don't understand if they're actually trying to halt or slow down the flow of immigrants into the country. Shouldn't they look at who's employing and why they're employing these people and where the money gets sent when it goes back to foreign countries? Because if that money's going back across to another border, obviously those people have a reason to send the money back there.
Owen, thanks for the call. And Seungmin, Owen highlights kind of a divide in the Republican Party. There's been a business-oriented pro-immigration wing of the party for a long time. They are not in the lead right now in the Republican Party, it would seem.
Definitely. I mean, I've been covering this issue for years, and there has always been the internal tension within the GOP over whether to allow in more immigrants or fewer immigrants. And now, obviously, the Republican Party is united on the fact that, you know, they need to take efforts to reduce illegal migration and that there should be more border security. But on whether just to simply allow more people in, there has been this big split because you do have the sort of the Chamber of Commerce wing of the party, sort of the establishment Republicans who believe that more labor really does benefit the broader economy, the broader labor market, and they point to various agricultural sectors or what we call kind of the low-skilled workers, and where they say there is a lack of workers and they need people in those positions to be able to keep the economy humming and running. But that has been really that's been resisted by the likes of former Attorney General Jeff Sessions in the past, particularly when he was a senator. But you do see that view gaining more influence kind of brought with the Republican Party. So that is a divide that is going to persist. It's kind of been on the back burner for now, but clearly a split that exists.
Thanks for that call, Owen. We'll go to Sue with us in Door County now. Sue, hello.
Hi. I don't even have the words to express what I feel about someone in the United States is going to determine what credible fear is and trying to lower the amount of people who reach that level by 50%. We live in a country that has a judicial system. We spent 9 years living in Central America. I brought my children up there, and it's a totally different system. One of the problems with, I think, Central America is that their judicial system does not work. So for us living a very safe life to decide who is truly in fear and who is not, and I can imagine who they would put on that board to decide that, somehow a humanitarian thrust has to be put there.
Sue, thanks a lot for that call. Seungmin, how do we determine it? It is kind of subjective. How do we determine credible fear as part of that asylum claim?
Well, a lot of these determinations are done through the immigration courts, which points to another really significant problem in the immigration system, in the fact that the immigration courts, which are not kind of your standard courts, they are courts actually administered by the Justice Department, are just perpetually backlogged. I mean, a case that kind of gets started right now, the wait could be upwards of several years, 5 years, before it gets adjudicated, which is a significant problem. And that's been kind of one of the changes to the immigration system that both Democrats and Republicans have easily agreed on, that there does need to be more immigration judges going through these cases. Democrats feel, obviously, that more judges could help resolve cases in a lot of them in the asylum seekers' favor more quickly. And Republicans also say that this gives a chance to go through the claims a lot more quickly and not just have these migrants kind of detained indefinitely in these places. However, the president's actually been kind of interesting on this. He has said several times that he doesn't really understand the need for more immigration judges, but he's actually been the outlier on this one. And I think that any kind of big actual bipartisan attempts to change the immigration system and deal with this issue on the border will almost always include a lot more immigration judges.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more call on this issue. Jim is with us in Watertown. Jim is not with us in Watertown. We'll move on then. We're talking to Soongmin Kim from The Washington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national news. A related issue, though, Soongmin, President Trump ordering the State Department and Homeland Security to come up with a way to deal with people overstaying their visas while in the U.S. What kind of things are they looking at?
So they have eyed, well, the steps that they took this week are pretty preliminary for now, because they obviously, some of the more dramatic steps that they have taken in the Trump administration to target various immigration issues have been to outright deny visas. And you saw that with the various iterations of the travel ban early on in his presidency that was litigated multiple times, ultimately settled by the Supreme Court. But what this does is the president is just kind of taking a preliminary step, directing the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security to actually just find ways to combat the visa overstay issue. And a lot of times we look at illegal migration as the people physically arriving on the border, but the statistic has generally been about 40% of all the people who live here without legal status are the result of visa overstays. So they came here legally, but they overstayed their limited time that they had to be here in the country with status. So that's why the president has directed his administration to look at issues. Immigrant rights advocates say that, okay, so this executive order, this directive, there's not perhaps a lot of substance here, a lot of action here, but it could indicate that tougher actions would be coming down the road, and that's leaving them a little bit nervous about what those exactly what those actions would be.
Let's move on to another issue or two before we run out of time, Soongmin. Herman Cain, President Trump, one of his nominees proposed for the Federal Reserve Board, says he's out. President Trump says Herman Cain withdrew his nomination, asked not to be nominated. He was a businessman, pizza company founder, presidential candidate a while back. What are we hearing about why he is out of the running here?
Well, he's done a couple of interviews that have indicated that maybe he sees a limited opportunities in the public sector than he would in the private sector. But clearly, the issue here was the opposition from the president's own party, which namely Senate Republicans. As Herman Cain's name started getting floated around for the open Federal Reserve position, a lot of Republicans started to get a little bit more queasy about the prospects of having to vet him, having to confirm him, and giving him that seal of approval by a Republican-led Senate. And actually, there ended up being 4 Senate Republicans who indicated or said outright that they would not vote for him. Mitt Romney, the freshman senator, but also more well-known as the 2012 Republican presidential candidate who happened to run against Herman Cain for the Republican nomination that year, said, you need someone who would bring stability to the economy for the Federal Reserve, and I don't believe, and make the board less partisan, and he did not believe Herman Cain would be that person. Other Republican senators such as Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Cory Gardner of Colorado, and Kevin Cramer of North Dakota, who was interesting because he is a staunch Trump ally, all expressed concerns and indicated that they could not at this point support him for the Federal Reserve, which ultimately doomed his nomination.
And just briefly in our last few moments, Stephen Moore, conservative pundit, also up for an open position. What are we hearing from Republican senators, if anything, about him?
So his the fight over his nomination, or his pending nomination, since it is an official at this point, is has gotten a little bit conflated with Herman Cain. So the Republicans don't have as much of a problem with Stephen Moore, at least for now, as they did with Herman Cain. But clearly that could change once Republicans start vetting his record more closely. And Mr. Moore has had a series of controversial statements come out over the last several days about his writings in the past in conservative publications or in various speeches. Democrats will do their best to highlight all those controversial remarks. Democrats by themselves don't have the power to defeat Trump's nominee, since it only needs a simple majority in the Senate, and the Senate is controlled by Republicans. But we shall wait and see whether if there is concern that it grows enough among Senate Republicans for Mr. Moore's nomination to get derailed.
Sungmin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Sungmin Kim, White House reporter at The Washington Post. She was with us for our weekly roundup of some of the top stories in national politics. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the idea of making it harder to seek asylum here in the United States. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Wisconsin is falling behind the rest of the country, and a creature known as the snot otter is to blame. Yesterday, the governor of Pennsylvania signed a law declaring the state's new official amphibian. The lucky creature is the eastern hellbender salamander. The 2-foot-long amphibian is nocturnal, covered in mucus, and it's also known as the devil dog, the Allegheny alligator, the lasagna lizard, and yes, the snot otter. The hellbender was selected in part because it's an important environmental indicator and it highlights issues related to water quality in the region. According to the New York Times now, 20 states have an official amphibian. So what is Wisconsin's official state amphibian? I did some hard-hitting investigative journalism by going to the Wisconsin Historical Society webpage. The answer? We don't have one. Not one. The state animal is the badger. The state wildlife animal is the white-tailed deer. State bird is the robin. The state fish is the muskie. The state dog is the American water spaniel. The state insect is the honeybee. And the state symbol of peace is the mourning dove. But that is where the state fauna ends. There's no amphibian. It's a time for us in Wisconsin to be worried about an amphibian gap, where we're getting left behind by the rest of the states. I, of course, can't lobby for legislation or official proclamations, but the issue is out there. Also, I learned I thought that the lactobacillus had been declared the official state microbe. That actually ended up falling short. So we don't even have one of those. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.